Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Race and culture in the United States. In celebration of Black History Month, join me now for conversations featuring scholars of philosophy and literature from Harvard University and Williams College. Race has always been a shaping force in American society, but both historians and scientists agree that the very concept of race eludes definition, mainly because it's more the product of culture than of biology. Listen now for Anthony Appia of Harvard University and David Smith of Williams College. I asked them to comment on the interplay between race and culture in our society. You'll hear first from Anthony Appia.
I think that it's important for philosophers to contribute to the discussion about race and racism by trying to do what philosophers do best, which is to clarify the notions with which we operate in certain fields. And I think one of the most helpful beginning things to say about the relationship between race and the concept of race and the rest of culture is that one of the difficulties we've had, I think, is that the word gets used in so many different ways, in so many different contexts. The way biologists use the word race to talk about geographical variation within a species of birds, for example, may be perfectly okay, but it sounds as though it's giving legitimacy to the application of the very same notions to humans, and that can get you into difficulty. So the first thing that I always say when I'm talking about race is, let's try and get clear, let's try and say what concept we think we're operating with, because what all of these categories have in common, of course, is a connection between a way of thinking about people in terms of descent and questions of politics and power. Now, I don't think I want to say that every philosopher should think that she or he should spend all their time working only on questions which have policy consequences in the next 5 minutes. That would be to go too far to the other extreme. I do still find myself interested in questions in metaphysics, whose connection with whether you should vote Republican or Democrat are probably rather hard to figure. But I think that there is no reason why the philosophical style of reasoning and argument can't be applied. In fact, I think it must be applied by those of us who care about our world as citizens to problems that are of practical importance. And one of the difficulties, I think, about the role of intellectuals in this country, again, speaking as someone who came here from somewhere else, I obviously came here because I think it's a great place to be an academic and an intellectual at this moment in history. I think it's very exciting to be an American intellectual, but part of the difficulty of being an intellectual in America is because it's not just people outside the academy who seem to have the notion that we don't that the pointy-headed intellectuals should sort of keep to their own sphere. There are too many people in the academy, I think, who think that, and who think that intellectual standards can only be maintained by disconnecting yourself from live, urgent, real issues. Well, I think the opposite is true. I think that intellectual standards, the test of your intellectual standards, is that you can apply the tools and methods to serious questions.
If you could turn your powers as a philosopher to questions of race and ethnicity as you look around America in the 1990s, I'm not asking for an answer, Anthony. I'm asking for just a survey of the problems that that exist out there. Where would you turn? What would you engage with?
I think that I would begin with a question which it's surprising to say it's necessary to address, which is the question of what is wrong with racism. Where
You're going to tell me there's something right about it?
No, I'm not going to tell you something right about it, but I am going to tell you that I think that most people haven't thought about why it's wrong.
I see.
We have this reflex now, and the same thing I think can be said about sexism. We have this reflex in which once something's been characterized as racist, whether correctly or incorrectly, that sort of stops people discussing what actually went on.
And you see that as a danger.
And I think that's a danger. I think that we have to think seriously about what the mistakes are in racist thinking. And I think that one of the reasons that's important is because there isn't just one. There isn't just one thing that's wrong in the last, say, 100 years of practices that we call racist. There are various errors. Some of them are intellectual errors. Some of the errors of scientific racism were just intellectual errors. They were intellectual errors of thinking that notions that work perfectly well in a sort of loose social way for classifying people could be used as the basis for a science of human variation.
Mm-hmm.
It was not an unreasonable idea that the gross morphological differences between Africans and Europeans corresponded to something deep in biology. It was a perfectly reasonable research project at one level. The trouble is, it's not true.
Uh-huh.
And it's taken a while to find that, in part because of all the prejudices that surround differences between human beings. Let me give you a specific social example.
Fair enough.
It's regularly the case that African Americans who are who don't speak with African American, recognizably African American accents, are taken to be phony.
Uh-huh.
Now, this seems to me, the presuppositions of this seem to me, in the end, racist. In the end, it seems to me that there's no way of explaining why you think that must be phony unless you think that there's a way that people ought to behave in virtue of their belonging to a certain race, and that anyone who doesn't behave in that way is deliberately and failing to behave as he or she should naturally behave, or something like that.
Now you're making a prediction, and you're thinking categorically.
Right.
You're coming to the conclusion before you look at the evidence.
Right. Uh-huh. And it just seems to me that that's this is actually being discussed a good deal at the moment in sort of black-owned media in this country. You can read articles in Emerge and Jet and Essence about the question of the self-identification of younger Americans who are of, as people would have said in the past, mixed racial ancestry.
Uh-huh.
And there was a program on NPR the other day, I believe, in the course of the evening news program.
Uh-huh, about black males.
Right. Uh-huh. And about the ways in which some people who are dark-skinned in this country, but say were raised by a white parent who was separated from their black parent, they're asking them the reasonable question, why should you expect me to behave in any particular cultural way? I was raised in this suburb. My friends speak in a certain way, care about certain things. Why shouldn't I?
Right.
Now, it seems to me that there isn't any way of saying why you should act in that way, in the proper way for a black person, that isn't essentially racist.
Anthony Appiah, let me ask you to reflect on this. Is it necessary for me to be black or for you to be white to understand what's going on in the other guy's mind?
Nope.
I mean,
Absolutely not.
Is that after a fashion to come at this, the question of race and philosophy, and to attempt it sympathetically,
mm-hmm.
and to propose that to you, is that an inverted form of racism to say
no.
that I've got to get inside this skin and you've got to get inside the white sensibility?
Actually, I said it's a mistake, I think, to think that.
Mm-hmm.
But the mistake is actually not one that's particularly about race. It's a very widespread mistake. You get the same thing in some talk about women's experience and the inaccessibility of women's lives to
right.
to male understanding and so on. You get it in some discussions in the philosophy of history about whether we can understand Athens in the 5th century B.C.
Or yeah, I mean, to say this ends the conversation.
It does. I mean, and fortunately, it's also not true.
Uh-huh.
I mean, sometimes the truth is unpleasant, but I think in this particular case, the truth is that there are no two human situations which cannot be made accessible to each other with sufficient patience. Now, I would say that, again, coming from outside the United States and a little bit of anthropologically speaking, one of the things that you see, and we sort of foreign scholars in the academy can help Americans to see, is that is how much Americans who are aware of their differences have in common with each other. Just as from close up you can tell us about the varieties and nuances and textures of American society, so those of us who can look from a little bit of a distance away can point out to you the extraordinary range of consensus across ethnicities, across gender, and so on in the United States, and to remind you from a sort of outsider's perspective of all the possibilities of human life that have been essentially ruled out in America. I mean, for example, slavery. That's mm-hmm. a possible form of human social organization, and it's been ruled out, and there is a massive consensus, even amongst American racists, I think, it would be agreed that you shouldn't reintroduce slavery, right? So it's important to remember the things we have in common, and part of the importance of the humanities, I think, is to allow people to move between the two poles of seeing how various human cultures are, on the one hand, and at the other hand, of seeing that there is much in common between any two human cultures. There may be no human essence, there may be no one thing that you can say that's what all human beings have in common, but take any two people, and I don't care where you take them from, what parts of history, what parts of the planet, you will find things, human things, and not just basic, not just birth, copulation, and death, but more subtle, more high level, more culturally important things that they have in common and that they can share. So, tremendously important, I think, role for the humanities pedagogically, and I mean pedagogically in the sense of teaching the culture, not just teaching students in classes, to be aware of those subtleties and complexities at the same time as having an understanding that as humans we have so much in common.
Anthony Appiah teaches at Harvard University with the Nigerian Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka. He serves as editor of Transitions, a journal of modern African culture. This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You're listening to the third segment in a series of programs for Black History Month. The African-American historian and social critic W.E.B. Du Bois once noted that the color line would be a defining problem of life in modern America. I asked one scholar currently in residence at the National Humanities Center to reflect on Du Bois' statement. David Smith is a professor of English at Williams College. During his year at the center, he's at work on a project entitled Thinking About Writing About Race. David Smith.
At the beginning of The Souls of Black Folk, Du Bois observes that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, which is probably the most famous line that Du Bois ever wrote in his long career. And one obvious way of understanding that is that Du Bois is talking about the conflict between black and white in America and between Europe and the Third World internationally, racial conflict as we commonly understand it. From my point of view, there's another way of understanding what Du Bois is getting at in that passage. Certainly he meant that first sense that I've described, but I think there's also a possibility of thinking that he means something more profound than that, the color line itself, the creation of social definition based on color, upon so-called race, is itself problematic, and that continuing that kind of understanding of human relations is always going to generate the same kinds of problems over and over again.
Uh-huh. Do I have it right that up until the 18th century, just a couple of hundred years ago, the word Negro, if we were talking Spanish or Portuguese, I would say negro, has to do simply with a coloration, not with skin pigmentation, and not with what we call race.
Well, once again, it depends on where you're talking about, and the forms of racial definition varied in different societies. It wasn't the same thing in Brazil that it was in Cuba, mm-hmm. and it wasn't the same thing in Cuba that it was in South Carolina, in Virginia.
The point is, though, that we eventually equated the word Negro and the word black with the word slave. And this is how we have attached to this word some of its negative baggage, a lot of its negative baggage and connotation.
to a very large degree. Of course, there were always free blacks in America. Mm-hmm. There were 500,000 free blacks in America in 1860, almost a quarter of a million in the South, and a similar number in the North. But they didn't really count in how we thought about race. It was the slave mm-hmm. that defined what blackness meant. So to stop assuming that we know something's fundamentally important about writers or about individuals once we can identify them as black. We don't assume very much about what white means. We assume a very great deal about what black means. One of the reasons that I got involved in what some people call interdisciplinary studies is because I was very when I began to read Southern literature, for example, dealing with the Reconstruction period, it seemed important to me to know whether Thomas Dixon's claims about the Klan, for example, mm-hmm. had historical validity. I could see how the narratives worked as narratives, but when people read a work and respond to it, it's based not only on a kind of hermetic reading of the integrity of the narrative, but it's also based on their understanding of social issues and what has actually happened in history.
In other words, you're saying that Gone with the Wind can or cannot be good history. It can be good fiction, but it isn't necessarily a reliable accounting of the past.
Exactly. So at the very least, I needed to read history books. Mm-hmm. And as you begin to investigate these things, you realize that history is, of course, informed by other disciplines. Also, you have to read some political history, and you have to read some anthropology. So simply trying to understand literary works got me involved in the study of other disciplines. But there are traditions that I work within. I mean, much of the work that I do is rhetorical criticism, mm-hmm. Which is a very, very old tradition, going back at least as far as Aristotle. And what that means, to put it very simply, is that I'm concerned with how authors attempt to persuade and what constitutes persuasive writing. What are they appealing to in their audience?
Well, does this make of you, as it were, a black conservative, David Smith, because you would appeal to the devices and the authority of, I guess one word for it is the canon, these received, inherited notions of what constitutes persuasive writing, rhetoric, literature. On the other hand, you go in the direction of somebody like Houston Baker, who says, no, he brings to the interpretation of literature terms like blues ideology and the African-American matrix. We have a kind of an icon buster at work here. Where do you fall onto that scale of interpretation?
Well, I'm not sure where I fall on that scale. Houston Baker is a great improviser, takes great pride in.
It's like
in
a musician almost.
Yes, uh-huh. He embraces that model of performance,
right,
as the metaphor of what he does. In certain respects, I'm more conservative than that, because I do want to claim that I am a literary critic. You know, mm-hmm. that what I'm doing is reading texts.
And, a literary historian looking at models and making continuities.
Yes, a historian or an anthropologist or whatever, mm-hmm. but what I'm doing is reading texts. So there are certain disciplines involved in serious literary criticism. I think it's important to attend to those. From my point of view, as a kind of eclectic critic, I want to be able to do different things at different moments, depending on what kinds of questions I want to raise.
Sure.
There are forms of inquiry that are appropriate to pursuing those questions. And so I guess the renegade move that I make as a critic is to say that I don't want anybody else to prescribe for me which questions I can ask. Mm-hmm. But once I've decided on a question or a set of questions, it then becomes incumbent on me to be in control of the disciplines that I used to pursue those questions.
What kinds of new vocabularies or fresh terms do we need to bring to an understanding of thinking about writing about race?
I think what we more importantly need to do is to throw out a lot of familiar vocabulary. In other words, what I would like to see would be a kind of egalitarianism, mm-hmm. for us to approach all pieces of writing with the same open-mindedness, and not to assume in advance that we know what the attitudes or perspectives of any given author will or should be.
Simply because he or she is black or white.
Let us not make assumptions about blackness or whiteness, but to ask ourselves, what is the perspective mm-hmm. That manifests itself in this text? What are the attitudes? What cultural resources are being used here? Not, does this person use jazz and the blues, and if not, why not?
Right.
But let us read the work first and see what's there to be analyzed and responded to. So I think it's not helpful for us to try to divide experience up by beginning with the racial identity, the alleged racial identity of the authors, but to look at the content of the work and to go from there and trying to understand what is the meaning of this.
What would we do without our stereotypes, huh?
We need them. And that's why race is so powerful as a force, because it doesn't just disable, it also enables.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what complicates things so profoundly.
Let's turn to another phrase that you've used, David Smith, and that is the fiction of black and white. Let me load the question. Does this mean that you're optimistic about race relations in this country when you use a phrase like the fiction of black and white, that somehow or other the what appears to be racial inequity, that it's surmountable, that we can come to some sort of a harmony?
What I mean about the fiction of black and white is simply, I think it's false, especially at this point in history, to be claiming absolute distinctions between European tradition and African traditions in our contemporary culture. And I think that when you look realistically at 300-plus years of black and white coexistence in America, what we have is a culture that's new. It's a new thing in the world.
It's not African, it's not one or the other.
No.
Yeah.
And the influences back and forth uh-huh. here in America have been at work for so long that it's almost impossible to trace back pure forms. It's almost pointless to be making claims about what is purely African, what is purely European. There's perhaps some point for specialists to try to understand those fine points.
So you are
broadly speaking,
you're optimistic. This is what I hear coming through in this conversation.
Well, that's not quite optimism. I think that's simply empirical reality.
All right.
That if you talk about American music, what we have is a form that is a hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just African. It's not just European. No matter which tradition of our music you're talking about, I mean, I think even American classical music, which is perhaps the most resistant, is deeply influenced by the presence of African culture, African descended culture in America.
Sure.
It's different from European style. But as for the future, I don't know, Matt. I think that it's clear that there's great staying power to the kind of racial arrangements that we have already.
Huh.
So it's easy to imagine maintaining into the future and to project the changes that have happened into the future. You know, that a black professional class has gained a kind of acceptance by the elites. And so integration has succeeded to a degree at the very top
mm-hmm.
of society. It's affecting a relatively small number of people. But one could imagine that continuing into the future. But on the other hand, we shouldn't let that blind us, you know, the success of the few to blind us to the
misfortune of the many.
It's not just misfortune, but the continuing oppression of the vast majority of not just black people, but also white people. In some ways, the white working class is the most voiceless group in America, because one of the things that the term white allows us to do is to look only at the privileged whites and to pretend that all whites in America are somehow privileged, to pretend that someone like George Bush speaks for the average white American. Mm-hmm. And that's simply not true. I think that the emergence of someone like David Duke, among other things, reflects the desperation and frustration of working white people who don't have representative voices.
David Smith, again, I want to thank you for your participation on Soundings. You teach English at Williams College. You are engaged in a project that has the title Now Thinking About Writing About Race. I wish you well in your work.
Thank you.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to the third segment in a series of programs for Black History Month 1992. The speakers were Anthony Appiah of Harvard University and David Smith of Williams College. If you'd like a cassette copy of their discussions, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 594. That's program number 594, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes, and when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, part 4 of Soundings for Black History Month. Join me for conversations about black feminist literature and about the African-American social critic Alan Locke. I'll talk with Hortense Spillers of Emory University and Jeffrey Stewart of George Mason University. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Race and Culture in the United States, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Anthony Appiah of Harvard University and David Smith of Williams College. Appiah discusses race and philosophy. Smith explains our changing understanding of the concept of race, which is more a product of culture than of biology. Race and Culture, the third segment in a series of programs for Black History Month, this week on Soundings.